leaders who may be uncertain about how to bring diversity together. Though I don't feel I've been held back, I think I have been misunderstood. And I think there are probably many things that I think sometimes women in the workplace, their intention is misattributed. So, you know, if emotion is shown, sometimes people think that's weakness. Or if ambition is shown, it's seen as arrogance. So I think sometimes, though I don't think I've been held back, I do think that I've had to kind of explain my motivations more, because I think sometimes they've been misunderstood. And I have to say that probably may not have been the case if I had been a male in the workplace.
Hello and welcome to the Building Better Leaders podcast, brought to you by Scaffold Coaching. I'm Rachel Sullivan.
And I'm John Tattersall.
Hello and welcome to episode 31 of the podcast. This week, along with the rest of the world, we are celebrating International Women's Day. A few months ago, John and I were chatting about what we might do for International Women's Day and who we would really like to get on the podcast to talk about the subject of being a woman in a senior leadership role. And we were both reflecting on some of the inspirational women leaders that we've had over the years. And a few names came to mind, but I decided that I would reach out to perhaps the first inspirational woman leader that I worked for. I am, of course, talking about Catherine Whitten, who is the outgoing CMO of Specsavers currently. I met Catherine when I got my dream job working at British Airways back in 2007-2008. Catherine, at the time, was the head of global and UK marketing communications. It was a really senior role. I was in a very junior role. I can't believe she even remembered me, to be honest, let alone agreed to be on this podcast. But I'm so delighted and excited for you to hear this conversation. I often reflect on some of the leadership that was demonstrated by Catherine when I worked at British Airways, even now, 13 years on. And I think this is what the theme of this podcast is all about, how when we meet an inspirational leader, when we have the privilege and the absolute amazing experience of working for somebody that really does care about us, that inspires us, and that we really feel like we are working together on something, it really imprints on you. And this is the thing for me, having a really great leader can change the course of your life. And I can't tell you how grateful I am to have worked for somebody as inspirational as Catherine. So in this podcast, she shares with us her leadership journey. She was CMO of Barclaycard, most recently CMO of Specsavers. We talk about all different things around where she started in her career, how she was brought up, working on some of the world's most iconic brands. And of course, it would be amiss of us not to talk about should have gone to Specsavers. So of course, we will cover that at the end of the podcast. It's incredible. I hope you get a lot out of this conversation. Catherine is what I can only describe as an absolutely incredible leader, and I feel really privileged to have worked for her. And of course, if you are working for an inspirational leader and you would like to nominate them to be on the podcast, we are always on the lookout for inspirational leaders to have as guests. If you do work for somebody that you would like to nominate, please email us at leaders@scaffoldcoaching.com. Thank you. Catherine, welcome to the podcast. Do you want to just introduce yourself and tell our listeners a little bit about your leadership journey to date?
Absolutely. Well, listen, it's an absolute delight to be talking. I'm so pleased you made contact, but it does make me feel older than I already feel at the moment. When you said 13 years ago, my God, how time flies. So I have been working in marketing pretty much all of my career. A quick potted history of where I find myself today. I suppose if you look at my career to date, it's really been around two key axes. So I've worked in agencies and I've worked in in-house roles. And then the other axes are sectors, apart from Specsavers. So up to my time at Specsavers, I worked predominantly in payments and travel. So we met at British Airways, but when I was agency side, I led accounts like Virgin Atlantic and Eurostar. And on the payment side, I've worked for brands like American Express and Barclaycard. So Specsavers has been a departure, and it's been a fantastic departure to experience a new sector of healthcare and retail. I've spent 3 years at Specsavers. I'm actually leaving shortly, which is actually purely down to a decision around work-life balance. And it's the first time in my career I've had to trade off a job that I absolutely adore with a quality of life and living, because Specsavers is based in the Channel Islands in Guernsey. And I think the last year, the year of COVID, has really demonstrated to both me and my partner, Michael, that we missed a lot of things about being back in the UK and friends and family, et cetera. So taking the decision to leave Specsavers, come back to the UK and look for my next adventure.
How exciting. So we're recording this as an International Women's Day goal. And the reason I reached out to you is, you know, you massively imprinted on my leadership journey, my career. There's often points throughout the year where I'll reflect on something that you did 13 years ago as a leader. And I think, you know, there's a lot of men leaders that have also helped me massively in my career. But I do like to think about the inspirational women that I've worked for, and you have been one of them. So I want to say firstly, thank you very much for that. But I think it would be really nice of us to start this conversation by talking about your experience of being a woman in leadership. You know, we met 13 years ago. Your career was already really established by then, back in 2008. And I can imagine you've got a lot of stories to tell about what happened, you know, in the 90s to the noughties to the teens to now 2020. And just what's your kind of reflection, your observations about being a woman in leadership?
Yeah. Well, firstly, thank you so much for your very generous words. You know, as a leader, I think the biggest accolade you can have from anyone who you've had the privilege of leading is that you have left a mark and you have inspired in some way. So thank you for that. You know, I'm going to take you back pre-work, actually, because, you know, when you're asked to do a, you know, talk like this and for us to have a chat, it really kind of makes you start to reflect about where your inherent leadership came from. You know, I grew up in the Far East, I have always lived in a very diverse environment. So in some ways I was, you know, a minority because I grew up in Hong Kong. You know, my parents really imprinted into me a couple of things. One was the privilege again of living in such an amazing place. We spent 30 years there, and inspired me around curiosity, inspired me about being interested in others. And my mother did something which we used to, my brothers and I used to laugh about when we were slightly older, but it didn't matter what we did. You know, so the school report came in, you know, we weren't the brightest in the bunch, we were okay. My brother was slightly better at sports than I was. But, you know, whatever we did, my mother always used to ask us one question. And she would say, did you try your hardest? And if we said yes, she said, that is all I can ask of you. So it really, she put us on a pedestal for just trying. But, you know, I heard a motivational speaker the other day, a great guy called Steve Head, and he defined confidence as knowing that you have done your best, not necessarily being the best. So right from a very early age, I think my parents and I, you know, both my mother and my father, I thank them so much for instilling curiosity, for instilling confidence in me, because I really grew up thinking, as long as I try my hardest, I'm okay. And, you know, that leadership, those two things in particular, I think kind of stood me in good stead when I kind of reached the workforce. A couple of other things that happened to me in my early childhood, which I think are important when I reflect on it, is my parents never made any differentiation between me and my brothers. I mean, to the extent that we used to have the same haircut sometimes and dress in the same clothes. But also when I was in sixth form, I went to a boys' school. So there were just under 50 girls and 600 boys. And the school that I went to, it was very de rigueur at the time, because a lot of the boarding schools, boys' boarding schools, were taking girls because they wanted to improve their grades and get some more money in the door. I'm sure they wouldn't say that at the time. But the school that I went to actually said they didn't want to do that. They wanted to bring girls into the environment, but they wanted girls to reflect the overall culture. So they didn't want superstars. They didn't want, I mean, there were some girls who were incredibly talented and academic, but they wanted all-rounders. And the other thing they did is they integrated the girls into everything else that the boys could do or were doing. So I'd take rugby practice for 13-year-olds, not that I knew a lot about rugby, or take them for prep or whatever. Whatever my male counterparts were doing, they wanted the girls to do that too. So, you know, there are a couple of things there that, you know, I entered the workforce not really thinking about the differentiation between men and women with this curiosity and this inherent confidence. And I think over time, and there have been some quite shocking incidents through my career, and I'll refer to a couple of them that have still stay with me today, which then started to decode it for me that there is a difference. So the first one, and I won't say where I worked at the time, but I remember listening to a talk from a very senior woman in the organization. And when she was asked the question, how have you been so successful in your career to date? Her answer was, I've learned to act like a man. And I remember being totally shocked by that, because this is what I mean about kind of starting to unravel this fact that there is this difference. And why do you need to act like a man when you know? So it kind of, I said, it was like an onion that started to be peeled for me, that there was a difference. I remember another occasion, and actually a leader who I admired very much, who was very good to me, but he actually promoted me. And I remember he took me into his room after being promoted, and he told me about how I should dress now I'd been promoted, that I should wear suits and be able to, for my male counterparts to see that I was serious, but maybe with a brooch or a scarf.
Wow.
At the time I was like, wow, is that how you have to get on in this kind of environment? So those are just two incidents that started to make me think there was a difference. And then you hear, you know, over the years, I've heard comments such as decisions about hiring women based on how long they might be in the business because they might go off and have children. Mm-hmm. And, you know, things like that, that suddenly made me think, okay, there is a difference. And I think that has changed dramatically. But I do think that maybe bias has moved into unconscious bias more than, you know, unconscious bias is a word that we are all familiar with. But the thing for me that I always say and I always think about is, it is incumbent on any leader to bring the best people together. And the best people aren't necessarily about quotas of minority groups or whatever else. But the best people have to be this amazing hotbed of difference, because that's where the magic happens. And if leaders are unaware how potent that is when you bring people with different backgrounds, experiences, etc., then I think they've kind of got a gap in their leadership. And some leaders, I think, are uncertain about that. And you will hear this phrase about people hiring in their own image. Because again, it's a leadership quality to be able to bring difference together and learn how to make that work. It's not always easy. So I think that things have changed dramatically, but I still see occasions where leaders may be unaware of the benefit or uncertain about how to make that work. So progress, but still room to go.
Yeah. Just on that, obviously, you've explained that you've worked in two different sectors. What have been your observations of more on the kind of travel, creative marketing side, where it's been my experience that it tends to be more women? And actually, if you're a straight male, you may be in the minority versus possibly like more, and I don't know about this because I haven't worked in that environment, but payments and banking, where it may be more traditionally male dominated?
I'm not, to be honest with you, I'm not sure I would say that there was a massive difference.
Okay.
Because, and again, I think that, I think there'll be sectors that naturally attract people, you know, different types of people with different backgrounds. But what I will say is, you know, in every organization I've worked in, it, and I've been very fortunate in this, you know, as my career has progressed, it has been seen as important. Now, some have been more definitive in the actions they've taken, and some have just been, you know, have more room to go. But I think it's been recognised that it's important. And as I said, I've been incredibly fortunate through my career that I've never felt that I haven't been given an opportunity because I'm a woman.
Yeah, that's amazing. And I think that's confidence that your mum and dad inspired in you may have, you know, been such a definitive thing in your career, because it's such a gift to be given.
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, the one thing I will say, and again, it's this point I made about leaders who may be uncertain about how to bring diversity together, is, though I don't feel I've been held back, I think I have been misunderstood. And I think there are probably many things that I think sometimes women in the workplace, their intention is misattributed. So, you know, if emotion is shown, sometimes people think that's weakness. Or if ambition is shown, it's seen as arrogance. Or if assertiveness is shown, it's shown as aggression, or it's seen as aggression. So I think sometimes, though I don't think I've been held back, I do think that I've had to kind of explain my motivations more, because I think sometimes they've been misunderstood. And I have to say that probably may not have been the case if I had been a male in the workplace.
Catherine, wonderful to have you on the show, and a really interesting opening when you're reflecting on how your parents brought you up with these really fundamental values that you've been able to take into the workplace. You mentioned a few things there where you feel you might have been, you have been misunderstood. How did you get around those challenges? Did you do any leadership training, or was it really around seeing how other people operated and you lifted your experience from that?
Yeah. You know, it's a great question. I think the best leadership training that I have done is about helping me understand and be self-aware of my impact. And, you know, I had a boss, a wonderful boss, at Barclaycard, a guy called Dave Chan, who we used to talk a lot about intention and impact. So the worst thing is when those two don't align. So and you are misunderstood around your intention, because how someone, in some ways, it doesn't really matter what you give out; it's how it's transmitted. And, you know, the leadership training that has been very, very defining for me has been how I have learnt about myself and my motivations, and the awareness that I have around intention and impact. And so, you know, when something has been delivered and it has landed wrong. So what, and again, you know, I took upon myself quite early in my career, which didn't always go down brilliantly, if I felt that my intention hadn't landed appropriately, I would always go and talk to that individual and try and sort it out, which, you know, that gets easier as you get older.
Yeah.
Because your natural confidence grows anyway. But I always thought that it was important to have those conversations to at least get someone to understand what the intention was and to apologize if it landed inappropriately or it landed in the wrong way.
Yes, and that, I think people don't always remember what you said, but they'll always remember how they ended up feeling. Yeah. And I think that's a really powerful leadership trait, because people who are working for you may not feel that they could come to you and say, this is not really what I expected. But when you turn it around, turn the tables around, I think you're giving a lot of yourself to say, I'm just checking in to make sure that I got that right.
Yeah. No, John, I absolutely agree with you. My top tip when I talk to my team, if they have experienced something they're finding difficult to navigate, or they've had a challenging conversation with somebody, is the first thing I'll always ask them is, do you think there was positive intent? Do you think that person was out to make you unhappy? And 9 times out of 10, people say, well, no, I don't think they're a bad person. So I said that, you know, the easiest way to broach a conversation is to go to that individual and say, listen, when we met the other day and you said blah, 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 this is how it made me feel. Because that is undeniable. Because how someone feels, nobody can challenge. You know, anyone can say, well, I didn't mean that or whatever else. But it's a good way, because you give something of yourself. And you start that conversation to try and, you know, to make things better by a truth of yourself. Mm. And I think it 9 times out of 10, I think it works.
So in that, was the main learning, the way that you learned this through role modeling by that previous boss, Dave, was it at Barclaycard, or was it something that you've worked on constantly? I'm just kind of, you know, it's quite a unique thing to grasp so early. And I certainly felt that you did that a lot when we were at British Airways. So it's just like, how did you learn that?
Judah, I think the thing with leadership is, absolutely, there is a skill of leadership. But I think there also has to be something inherent in you. So, you know, what are your motivators? And my motivators have always been, from a very early age, to do my best, to enjoy what I do. I love people and I love bringing people together. And I've always loved helping and enabling people. So, you know, I think that, again, they form core pillars of who I am. And I think the leadership training, and I have received some excellent leadership training over the years, I think they just help you refine that. But there needs to be, you know, you guys will know more than anybody else, excellent leadership is about authenticity. I always say you can't hold your breath too long. And if you're not being yourself, it is like holding your breath, and it's incredibly, tiring. And in the end, it will kind of make you not very well.
Yeah.
And people will see through it. So, you know, a lot of the traits of leadership are just about our personality traits as well, that you become skilled at knowing how to use because of experience. And because, by the way, I've got a lot of it wrong along the way. It's about making a pledge to yourself that you of betterment. And, you know, and I say this, and I don't say this lightly, it is a privilege to lead other people. I always say to my teams, like, please don't talk about managing people, because you manage a conveyor belt. But really think about the responsibility of leadership. And, you know, and I personally take it very seriously. So I try and be being skilled at using my my natural self, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah. And just continuing on from that, so you've mentioned that you've had some really inspirational and excellent leaders. How have you managed when you've been working with people that haven't been so inspirational, or perhaps working for people that have been through difficult times and therefore have been difficult to work for? Yeah. How have you managed to work and navigate through those instances?
Yeah, I suppose probably in two ways. One is, you know, whoever you are, you know, in whatever kind of work that you do, or indeed in life, you kind of have a responsibility for everybody. So, you know, for if you can make a positive impact on someone's life, so whether that be someone who works for you, for a peer, for your boss. And I think that idea of care is really important for your leader relationship as well. So, you know, there have been times where I've had bosses who have gone through really difficult times, either in the workplace or at home. And, you know, I've always made sure that I am there and they know I am there to do whatever I can to support them. Because that also, and because sometimes leaders find it difficult to ask for support, but support can come from anywhere. And the other thing is, in those situations, really working out what I need from that individual to support me. And so probably being a little bit more directive in that than maybe in other situations, because if it's not naturally going to be kind of coming to me in that dialogue, I've found ways to say, what I'd really love from you to help me is X, Y, and Z. So versus kind of saying, oh, they're rubbish and we don't get on, or you know, whatever. It's actually probably moments where I've taken more accountability for my own development and being assertive, not aggressive, in asking for the support that I need.
John and I talk a lot in our leadership training around the skills of followership, and what you've just explained then is your role modeling being the first follower to your team by supporting your leader. And one of the tips I learned quite early on, probably after I'd worked from you actually, is that I got a lot back if I praised my boss. So I'd kind of like think, oh, who's actually telling them they're doing a good job, you know, especially if they've got a difficult boss. So, and I'd always be like really shocked by how they'd be like, oh my God, that's made my day. And I'd be like, oh, perhaps no, maybe we all need to be told we're doing a good job a bit more frequently.
Yeah, you know, I had a wonderful conversation the other day. So what I've been doing in my team currently, about 40 of the team work in the UK and the rest work in Guernsey or a couple other locations. So when you went back into lockdown at the end of January, I was like, I remember going to bed and being really upset about it, even though I was in Guernsey and it didn't affect us at the time. And just thinking, my God, how are people going to cope? So I kind of thought, right, every day I'm going to do something with a group of my UK colleagues in my team or individuals, just to check in, see how they are, make them smile, whatever. So one day I phoned someone in the team who's quite junior. I could tell when she answered the team's call, like, she was a little bit like, oh my God, what's happened? But I just said, listen, I just want to check in, how are you doing? You know, just this lady actually lives alone as well, so I was aware of that. Anyway, at the end of the call, she said, and how are you? And I went, oh, I'm fine. She said, what are you doing to look after yourself? And I was kind of taken aback, because she said, you know, unless you're well and you're in a good place, then that's going to be bad for all of us. Wow. And I was so taken back and so delighted, but I hadn't seen it through her lens, which is, we kind of need you, Catherine, to help us get through this. So make sure you're okay so you can help us, which was, it was delightful.
I think listening to you, Catherine, this care enabling, it comes through really strong as a really strong values for you. And Do you think that there are just some people who are more predisposed to being really effective leaders because it's almost inherent in their makeup? It's the traits that they have. And that can be difficult for other people that are just basically promoted out of doing really well in one area. And then the natural thing is that they then become the leader.
I think that for some people, it is, and this, by the way, I don't think has a gender bias. I think some people just inherently are concerned about the whole. So it's not just about, you know, are you meeting your objectives and your KPIs, etc., but are you thriving? Are you happy? You know, I always say to everyone, I probably said this actually when we were at BA, that we spend way too many hours at work unless it's fun. You know, so and show me somebody who's been successful in life, in any strand of life, unless they've really enjoyed what they're doing. You know, because you can't be your best unless you are feeling good in yourself. So I think some people inherently recognize that. And you're right, there are many occasions when people are promoted because they're good at doing one aspect of their job, which may be to the technical skills or whatever else. And, you know, I was talking to my leadership team yesterday, and we were talking about the people plan for next year. And one of the pillars was about, you know, creating followership. Because creating followership, to your point, is the highest point and, you know, output of leadership. And if you ask your question, why would someone follow you versus how do you become a good leader? It really starts people to kind of think about it. So, you know, it gets you above and beyond the hygiene factors of knowing how to create a good personal development plan, be able to manage difficult conversations, all those kind of, you know, base points of leadership, to inspiring, creating vision and caring. And we agreed, and I think the last 12 months has probably brought this to the fore. And I think if there are any positives of what we've all been through, I hope the biggest hangover is that people will start to, it will become top of mind for all leaders, that it's not just about what people are doing, but it is how well they are in doing it. So we agreed yesterday as a leadership team, we took it to a vote, that as part of the personal development plans that we would have with the teams going forward, yes, we'd ask them to look at their skills and their competencies and how they can be the best in their jobs today, what their career path is. But we would also have a column for someone to complete on their one pager around self-care. Because it naturally, it does a couple of things by putting it into that development discussion. One is, it's as important as any other part of your development. Because if you're not, you know, physically, mentally well, and at your best, you're never going to thrive. So it highlighted the importance, but it also gave leaders who found that not natural to have those conversations a way to bring it up in a kind of authentic way, because it was about how you can be your best. And, you know, as I said, I really hope everyone said yes, and we all voted with hearts and thumbs on the screen, and we took it down. So I'd be really fascinated, because obviously I won't be there next year, but to see how that goes.
I just want to give context to our listeners, though, on how ingrained this is in you, because I think a lot of people will have come to this realization through 2020 themselves, and the subject of kind of remote working and preparing people to work differently has come to the forefront. But I reflect back on my time at British Airways, and you know, this was 2008. And I don't know whether you'll remember saying this, I bet you don't. But what I always remember at British Airways is, even then, we were to work on the Wednesday in London. So we were to have a day away from the office. And then because of car parking, so it was a logistical problem, but you almost then insisted that we work from home one day a week. So we were working in 2008, one day in London, one day from home. And we also had the flexibility to come in where within a boundary of like between 8 and 10. And I always remember, like, I'd come from a place where we'd have to clock in and out. And then I kept messaging my boss and saying, I'm so sorry I was late this morning. You know, I'd get in at 10 past nine. And she's like, for goodness sake, will you just stop telling me? And it was like, as long as you were kind of in for 10. But then I do remember that we were going through a restructure and it was quite stressful. And you said to, there was a group of us in the brand team, and you said, you know, if you haven't got anything to do, please do not sit there and pretend you're doing something. Go to an art gallery. And I bet you don't even remember saying it, but I was just like, whoa. You were like, go and feed your soul. You're in a creative team. Don't ask permission. Just go for the afternoon and bring back to the team what you've learned. And I was like, where does that come from? Like, I don't know. I've never had a leader that trusting, I guess, before or since.
I'd probably say the same today.
I knew you would.
I think it's really weird when you get into the workplace and you're working with adults. And, obviously in most organisations, there's some kind of hierarchy. But at the end of the day, you're working with mothers and fathers and adults. And suddenly this idea of trust goes out of the window. You know, you're not working with young children, you're working with adults. So I've always been, and again, because I've experienced myself with leaders, I always start with, I trust everyone in the team until they break that trust. Some leaders maybe think you have to earn the trust and then I'll give it to you. But I kind of think we're just a group of adults. I also believe that we spend way too many hours in work as well. If someone needs to come in a bit later or leave a bit earlier, 9 times out of 10, they're going to make that up and more. So, you know, again, it's about being respectful of the people in the team who are adults just like me. The number of instances over the years where I'd say the trust has been broken is fractional.
Mm.
So again, you know, it's about empowerment. It's about respect. And I think if you give that, you get it back.
What
I hear there, Catherine, is your parents talking, saying, have you done your best? Have you tried your best? Yeah. And yeah, wow. I can understand why people would follow you. I absolutely would.
Mm-hmm. Not everyone does.
No, but I think
always outliers, isn't there?
John and I work as we coach a lot of people, and I'd probably say 1 in 4 of the people we coach, we're coaching them out of a stress that they have created for themselves because they don't trust other people. And I am reflecting on that now, thinking about what you've just said and thinking, you know, that they stress about somebody not coming in, or that the fact that they don't come in on time, and how can they have that difficult conversation with them? And I'm thinking, you know, most of the time I'm having to talk them down because I'm like, have they done anything wrong? No, but they've not come in on time. And you're like, but is the work different? And it makes them ill, stressing to that degree, because they're not trusting their team. And I mean, usually in a coaching session, it comes back to what something is inherently that missing yourself. But it is interesting that starting point of trusting people first is actually more for your benefit than it is for them, probably in your enjoyment of work.
But, you know, I think you've hit the nail on the head, because in any sphere of your working career, again, whether it be in your team, whether you're leading a team, whether you're part of a team, the highest performing teams that I've been a member of, and I was talking to one of, who's a friend and was a colleague, who I was in this team with, and it was a senior team. It had responsibility for Europe at a board level, and there were probably 9 of us in that team, all from incredibly different backgrounds. I think out of the nine, there were seven nationalities. There was a mix of, a gender mix. We lived in different parts of the world. We still WhatsApp each other almost weekly. Aww. And that's kind of 9 years ago, 10 years ago, we worked together. And we were trying to work out what the secret sauce was. And I said it was about trust and respect. Because if you have that bedrock of trust, it gives you such a lot of confidence. As soon as trust and respect is eroded, it's like a relationship. It's kind of virtually impossible to rebuild it. And I have this quote actually on my computer, and it's and I read it and it just kind of made so much sense, which is when respect stops being served, get down from the table. And again, what I love about that is the importance of it, respect and trust. But when it's gone, don't battle it.
That is interesting, knowing when to bail out and realize it's not for you. Just to bring it back to the International Women's Day topic, I know we've gone round more of a leadership in general, but super useful. What would you say have been the biggest developments and positive changes over the last 10, 20, 30 years in terms of women in leadership and get into a more state of gender equality? What have you observed?
Well, I think that the most important thing is that businesses have realised the importance of it. So I talked a little bit about the beginning about maybe some of the unconscious bias that continues is about unawareness. But I think businesses understand the importance of it, and not to be kind of hard-nosed about it, but when businesses know it makes good business sense, I think doors start to open. Jack Ma from Alibaba, who stepped down on his 55th birthday, because I love this quote, he said he didn't want to die in his office, he wanted to die on the beach. What an incredible journey he had. And he is one of the biggest advocates in China of talking about the importance for the business of having women in the business. Because he says that, in the past, business strength has been about muscle, and now business strength is about wisdom. And he said, I hire as many women into the business as I can because they make the business better. So I think businesses have understood the benefit to the business. And I think that has opened a lot of doors. And I think women have more role models. And, as a leader of women, I hope to do one of three things. I call them the three C's, around inspiring women in the workplace and for them to develop further in their careers. And one is to inspire them to have courage. Because, and again, I don't want to be stereotypical here, but I would say of the conversations I have, women tend to doubt themselves more than maybe their counterparts. So I try and inspire people to think about courage. The second C is confidence. Confidence in their ability to be able to reframe themselves, particularly when they've had career breaks, coming back into the workforce. And then the third is about setting personal commitment. And I think those three things are what I was given the opportunity to develop myself through leaders I've had, to have the courage to ask for more, to take risks, to have the confidence to see a future. And the commitment is a really important one, because it is a two-way street, right? So businesses need to give those opportunities to women, but women need to take the opportunities as well. I think that those three things are really critical, and I think are more obvious today than they may have been in the past.
Yeah, absolutely. That final one is a new one. I'd not really thought about that, because you hear about the courage and the confidence a lot, and we certainly coach a lot of, again, you don't want to be stereotypical, but it tends to be more women coming with things like imposter syndrome for coaching, or women tend to come to a coaching session saying, I'm not sure how I would go about getting this, or I don't think I'm good enough. Whereas men tend to come to a coaching, and again, I'm generalizing massively, but saying, I want this, how can you help me get it? And just even in how we always start in coaching by reframing the issue, just even a line in the sand on how the conversation even starts, it is very different. But that commitment bit, that is about taking personal responsibility, isn't it? And I think that is something that we can all do, both men and women, actually.
100%. The thing is, I'll have development sessions, or I have skip level meetings with my team members, and I have something called Open Door every week that people can book in 20 minutes. They can come and talk about anything, a project, a gossip, career advice, what's on TV, anything. And I have these amazing conversations with people who I almost see them inflate, because they're like, oh, I'm not sure, and could I do this? And, and I talk them through it, and at the end, they're kind of like, yes, absolutely. So I'm like, right, what are you going to do? And they go, I'm going to do this, this, and this. And then you come back, 6 weeks later and go, so how's it gone? It's like, ooh. Because then I say to them, listen, this really comes down to your commitment to yourself. Because if you're not committed to yourself, then it's hard for others to be committed to you. And it is this balance, and it's really, really important. And I think that, and again, without being to stereotype, more women wait for recognition than go out and seek it, as I'm sure through the work that you do. So this idea of waiting to be rewarded and recognized for your hard work versus going out and creating that opportunity and to go, oh, by the way, and I can do it because I achieved this. So the commitment for me is really, really important, because without it, things aren't going to happen. Commitment to a diet, getting fit, getting a promotion. We're all adults. And it all comes back down to, are you committed to betterment? Because that's really what it is.
Mm.
I think it's really useful that you remind people of that, Catherine. But to be in a position to remind them should also perhaps reflect that it's maybe out of, do you think it's maybe out of a bad past experience that sort of stifles that commitment? And until you come along and you have somebody who'll support you and sort of put you on the right tracks, you doubt.
Yeah, 100%. And one of the questions I often ask people is, so if I can help them do that kind of that path thing, where is it they want to be? What do they want to get better at? What do they want to happen? I will always ask them, so that's brilliant. Great. That's when they're starting to pump up, and you can see that they're getting excited about it. Say, okay, right, what's going to get in the way? Because you're right, you know people who have got that self-belief and have personal commitment to themselves, and others who don't. But the thing you've got to do is, as a leader, I think, is to help them understand what the real blockers are, and potentially the imaginary blockers. I haven't got this background. I haven't got a marketing qualification. Well, I don't have a marketing qualification. I haven't done this, or so and so won't support me, or whatever else. I'm like, okay, let's go through one of each of these and knock them down, because 9 times out of 10 there's never anything. Unless they want to do something ludicrous, which obviously But nine times out of 10, if you just knock down, I almost see them as dominoes, like knock them down. Everyone that knocks down just adds to that confidence and commitment, you know?
Yes, we see that a lot, and it's really disappointing when you know that the people have got the all the ability to do it, but yet it's amazing how many darts people will throw at themselves, and a lot of those things are all created. Yes, they're born out of a bad experience, but they're still created in that own person's mind.
Yeah,
and it's really disappointing because you just know that they would inflate more, you know.
I the other thing I say a lot is, you know, learn from the past, but the past is the past.
Yeah,
you can't change it. It's all about the future. It's all about possibility. And the best thing that we can take from the past is learning. But when you start to drag your energy into the past, in any part of your life, it's toxic. It's not good, you know.
Reflecting on what you said about the final one being that commitment. What was the wording you used exactly? The commitment to your own development. I think in my 20s, I was very similar to you, Catherine. I think I'd been brought up with a mum that had always told me I can, and don't let anybody tell you can't. And very similar on the effort thing, and very gritty individual. And I was probably more, you know, I saw no difference in myself and any male. And I never had any issues because I never saw any issues. Do you know, isn't it amazing when you don't look for something, you don't see it. And then I guess in my 30s, I've perhaps seen it from a different side, and definitely having a child and motherhood, especially because I waited a bit. I was 36 when I had my child. It did affect me because I've been very used to getting what I wanted if I tried hard enough. Yeah. Baby's not like that. And then came back from maternity and then getting made redundant when I just had a baby. I do wonder about the difference between men and women, and perhaps women need more help on that commitment. And the reason I say this is I wonder if the map to success in inverted commas, whatever your definition is, it's possibly a little bit more straightforward for a man because they encounter less issues. I kind of think, you know, maybe it's more that there's a couple of different A roads they could take and a motorway. But for women, there's a lot more country back lanes. You know, it might be childhood, it might be a sick relative, and they're the ones that are more likely to have to take time off to be a carer. Yeah. The doubt is more prevalent in women. Historical things from upbringing and legacy, and these are not excuses, they're just realities that actually, for as much as I want gender equality, we are different, and I don't think we can pretend we're not. I think the day that we're trying to kind of make men have babies is the day we've probably gone bonkers as a species. I really liked that commitment, but I guess I'm trying to make sense of it myself. I think that you try and, I think that the pressure on women to try and do it all means that there are more ways they can get lost in that sense. And I'm a member of, I've tried to start another business, and John and I are obviously entrepreneurs with this business. I'm a member of a couple of entrepreneurial groups, and it astounds me how single-minded men can be when they need to be. And I'm like, oh, I try, but I'm like, my house, and these are all things I choose to, you know, my marriage, my house, my child, and my fella is a brilliant support. But I don't have that ability to just go away for 16 hours and because the cost of that is too big for me. So yes, I guess that's my observation from that. What are your thoughts on that?
You know, it's again, I had this conversation with someone quite recently who's returned from maternity leave and very high performer, and, you know, scoping out her personal development. And on those three C's, the courage, confidence and commitment, they're broader than just work. And what we talked a lot about is her priorities, because her priorities have changed since she was last in the workplace. And, you know, her commitment is to be the best mum she can be. And to be the best mum she can be, she needs to feel satisfied and feel that she's growing at work. So, you know, we talked a lot about being kinder to herself, because the judgment of her progression, my God, she's done the most amazing job, which is bring another wonderful human into the world. And so it's about balance, and it doesn't make her, and actually, ironically, because there's balance, she's grown emotionally. She has the ability now to make sure that where she is expending her energy at work is really making a difference. And I find, you know, I haven't had kids myself, but I find many of the women who I've worked with, when they come back from maternity leave, almost develop this superhuman capacity of discipline and prioritization, because they have to.
I'd second that, honestly. I wrote a blog on this when I came back, and I was like, don't take, there's no other way to say it, I don't take as much shit because I don't have time to, you know, and I think where you doubt yourself before, you're like, I could procrastinate on this, or I can make a decision and go home.
Yeah. And so, you know, so that commitment for me is understanding what your priorities are, and feel that, and the two priorities are being the best mum you can be and feeling as satisfied with your work. If you put those together, they're a whole lot more commitment than before you went on maternity leave, because you're doing two amazing things. And also, I think the other thing is that there are times in your career, and whether it's for men or women, or priorities outside of work. And, you know, reflect on my own career, you have growth spurts, you know, so the very fact that you want to reprioritize or have to reprioritize energy outside of work for personal reasons, for health reasons or whatever, doesn't mean that there isn't a great future for you if you want it. It just means that you've decided to use your energy in a very different way. And I think a lot of people, particularly when they're younger in their career, think things are finite. But if I take a sabbatical, you know, I'll never be taken seriously again. I'm like, why would that be? Because you've already invested, like, you know, 7 years in the workplace and in this company, and your personal brand is really strong, and you're going off because this is going to make you a, you know, happier and healthier. And you're going to come back stronger. Why would you come back weaker? But people take time out of the workplace. Oh, they've forgotten me. It's almost like they don't give credit to people going, she was bloody brilliant, or he was great before he went. Can't wait for him to come back. So I think, again, this is a confidence thing, which is, it's not finite. It's not if you make a decision because it's a life or personal priority, that things won't go back on track again. And it's happened to me. I had the same stresses when I was young, but I had great leaders who told me to kind of get a grip and you know, in the nicest possible way, which is, we can't wait for you to come back when the time is right. You know, and it's like, oh, great, good.
And I think you have to remind yourself, I really like that, what you just said then about it being a growth spurt. Because just because you're not progressing upwards, it doesn't mean that you're not developing. And actually, you know, I'm reflecting on my partner. He's very good at that. You know, he's much more patient than me. And I think this is it. When you've been very ambitious in your 20s and the growth spurts come quick and often, it can feel very uncomfortable and impatient 10, 20 years along, where the growth roles are less frequent, right? That there's less of them. And there's not room for everybody, but it doesn't mean that the growth's not there. It's just in a different area of your life, a more holistic you. Yeah, I really like that.
I think the other thing I'd say is, you know, and again, going back to the theme of today, is it's fantastic to have great role models in the fact that, you know, when you come back from maternity leave, that you can act and work in a different way. I worked again for a wonderful woman at Barclaycard, Balsarana Keating, you know, powerhouse New Yorker, and so inspiring. She had twins, you know, later in life, but she would declare, and it was kind of what I call an iconic action when I reflect back on it, that she would have dinner with her twins, who I think were about nine-ish, well, we worked together. She would have dinner with them 4 days out of five of the working days.
Wow.
So she would leave the office. I'm sure she worked into the wee hours of the night. But I can't tell you how important that iconic action was to other women, to say, wow, you know, she's declaring the commitment of balance. And in some ways, I kind of wish it had been a man declaring it.
Yeah.
Because it would have been even more potent to this commitment of balance. But I remember being blown away when I heard about it. And then I kind of reflect on thinking, what a great declaration. But more importantly, as I said, this iconic action, which I think many women who worked there at the time will probably cite it as something that changed the way they thought about the permission they had.
Yeah, I'm just reflecting on the last role I had in an ad agency, and there was a couple of men there that didn't work Friday, so they worked 4 days a week, and they were a little bit older. And it was wonderful that they were like, no, I'm not available that day, I spend it with my daughter. And you think, I love that. And when we had my when we had our little boy, my husband works 4 days a week. So he has a day at home with Felix, which is lovely, you know. And there's the odd, you know, amongst the football lot, there's all, oh, women's work, you know, that kind of thing. But it, you know, he just owns it. But I think we're seeing a lot more of that, of men saying, no, it's important to me too, which is really wonderful.
But I think, you know, and that's a really good point, because it's not necessarily because men feel that they have to do it, it's they want to do it.
Want to, absolutely.
And there's more probably societal permission. You know, in some countries, this is, you know, this feels like a very antiquated discussion, because they're much more progressive in some of the Nordic countries around more equality in the role of mother and fathering, or parenting, mother and father parenting. But I think what happens is there are more, it feels more acceptable. And really interestingly, though I don't, as I said, I don't have kids, my partner, Michael, he's a stay at home man. So he's not upset.
Father to dogs.
Exactly.
The dogs are his full-time.
Well, we've got two dogs now. But I've got, I've had three female leaders whose husbands stayed at home to be stay-at-home fathers. I have someone who works for me at the moment. Her husband stays at home as well. So again, that has changed dramatically, because at the beginning of my career, to go, oh, yeah, my husband stays at home to look after the kids, it would have felt really incongruous. But there are so many women that I know who have made the decision and the commitment around the balance of wanting to invest in their careers, whose husbands have said, I'll support you in that.
I had a boss at Vodafone, Kim Clark, she was a CMO, really inspirational. And she would share that information our company, you know, company-wide updates, and say my husband's at home with the kids and I'm working, and it was wonderful. And they were young kids, like really young.
I have to, you know, and I don't do this enough, I do have to thank Michael, my partner, because he's allowed me to do two things. He's allowed me to put the energy I've wanted to into my career. And he's also the one who will continuously tell me when to stop. So he also guides me about, okay, Catherine, I get you're committed, I get you love this, but get the balance right. So he's my kind of conscience as well.
Do you listen?
Not immediately, but if he says it enough, I mean, actually, while we've just been speaking, he's just texted me about something, which is make sure you don't do X, Y, and Z, and you spend time doing this, this, and this, which is about he's my kind of conscious of self-care.
Amazing. Yeah, I asked that because I'm thinking, I'm just reflecting, I'm having a hard time with a couple of things at the minute, and my husband is telling me that and I'm not listening. So I'm a note to self. Look, it would be amiss of us while we've got you to not chat a little bit on the concept of change in general. 2020, massive, huge year of change. You know, you're a CMO in the retail sector, tremendous amount of change. Role of the customer, tremendous amount of change. You're also changing roles, changing house.
Yeah.
What are your tips for managing change as a leader? And how have you personally tackled the challenges of 2020?
Yeah. Do you know what? I think what 2020 has probably proved to all of us, irrespective of whether you work, you have family, you don't. I think it has proved to all of us as humans the power of the resilience that we have that we never really thought we did before. Because if you had, you know, if we'd been having this conversation like 2 years ago and I said, imagine a world where we wouldn't be in the workplace and we'd been wearing masks and we wouldn't be able to hug our relatives, and I'm sure we would all go, oh, we couldn't do that. And so, you know, I think one of the big reflections I have is, and again, this builds confidence, goes back to this about inspiring confidence, that we are pretty sensational as human beings to be able to adapt, and the resilience that we have shown. And resilience has been really, really important. I think empathy has been probably one of the most important leadership traits during change. Because, and again, I'm going to steal a phrase only because I heard the wonderful Steve Head talk the other day, and he describes what we've all been going through in COVID as we've all been in the same storm, but on different boats. And what he was kind of saying is that we've all experienced it in different ways. So I think, you know, in terms of helping people through change, it is really being acutely aware of difference and feeling empathy for everyone's individual situation, because everyone's needed help, including me, in different ways, and we've reacted to different situations in different ways, etc. So listening has been really, really important, and being empathetic to people's situation, because everyone has had a different COVID experience. So I think they've been really important traits. You know, listen, we've all heard about pivoting, second most overused word of 2020, and changing at speed. And what I'm not going to be cynical about this, but what kind of makes me laugh sometimes when I hear companies going, oh yeah, and we pivoted and we changed and we became an e-com business and we did this in, you know, 3 months. And I kind of go, why didn't you do that before? You know, if you can move at that speed, why didn't you do that before? So, you know, necessity has been important. But really what I think has happened is it's created focus for people. And that's really why things didn't happen before. Because I think what I've tried to do to guide not just the marketing department, but I sit on the board of Specsavers as well, is to create acute focus. And that's why acute focus around the needs of the colleagues, acute focus around the needs of our customers. Specsavers is a partnership business. So we have thousands of partners who co-own their local stores. And they're kind of quasi small business owners. So we've been acutely focused on their needs as well, and really prioritizing what would make a difference. And once you strip away everything else and empower people to say, all you need to focus on is meeting these needs of customers, of colleagues, of our partners. It allows people to create that change. So look after the well-being of your colleagues, understand them, be empathetic, create focus, and then empower, strip away everything that now almost feels embarrassing, that we had meetings about, you know, writing decks and PowerPoint and, you know, because wonderment has been achieved by so many organizations because of focus.
Yeah, it would be amiss of me not to ask you a little bit about Specsavers, given, you know, I've been in the marketing industry for years and advertising is still my passion. I just love it so much. And I just want to chat to you about, you know, when you come into something like Specsavers as CMO, and, you know, it is a different business in that you've got the partners and the customer and the employees. So you've got another entity to deal with. But I think the thing that you know, you're always on a balance, aren't you, as a CMO, or, you know, I've been head of brand or any marketer, where you kind of like, you're judged on what you do, but what do you change and what do you keep? And I guess, you know, I did once have aspirations to be a CMO. I don't think that's a path I want to go on now, but you always think, as a CMO coming in, the temptation would be to change the tagline or the campaign. And I imagine you must have had to check your own ego a lot during that kind of thing, but what a gift that, you know, should have gone to Specsavers was in 2020, when the customers were doing your advertising for you and certain politicians, let's not forget. But what a gift when something is so powerful that your customers feel that they can engage and co-create advertisements with you. So talk us through very briefly, you know, you're coming into Specsavers. How do you balance that change, that fine line between what to change and what to keep?
Okay. So the first thing I'll say is, I think it's a privilege to be given any job. And we used to have, as part of the values at Barclays, the value of stewardship. And the idea of that was, you simply need to leave a role better than you found it. So it was never your God-given right to have it. You were never going to have it forever. You were caretaking it. And all you really need to think of is about how you left it better. So, you know, when I've kind of approached every job like that, when I arrived at Specsavers is and I could speak for hours, because it is a truly brilliant business and culture. Started by a married couple, Dame Mary and Doug Perkins, who are in the mid 70s now and still come to work every day. You know, and has had tremendous success globally, tremendous success. The majority of the markets have 40 to 50% market share. So you come in as a CMO and go, oh, they're doing quite well. What's my role? But they're a very ambitious business as well. So it's a bit half empty, half full. It wasn't kind of saying, well, we've got 50% of the market. How do we get the other 50% of the market? And Mary and Doug are very insistent, like, we want to help everybody. So how do we make ourselves, what's the thing that's not allowing people to experience us? So that was kind of the marketing and brand challenge, because, you know, and if you really think about it, what Specsavers has done remarkably well over the last 17 odd years is tell people that they're cheap and make people laugh. And for the 50% of people who reject Specsavers, it's not, they love, there's a lot of warmth about the brand, because humor is such a kind of universal tool to gain connection. But it's not about being cheap. It's not about price, it's about value. And we hadn't told the story, the amazing story of the professionalism and expertise of our optometrists, the quality of our products, the pillar of the community stuff that gets done in our stores, etc. So it was very quick for me to realize that we had to build on the personality. And sometimes people get personality and should have mixed up together. Should have is just a device to reflect the personality of the brand, which we define now as warm and witty, knowledgeable and down to earth. So the most frequently asked question I've had since I started Specsavers, are you going to kill Should Have? I'm like, well, kill the golden goose. I don't think so. But it needs to play a different role. And the role it was freed up to play through the strategy that I put in place was let Should Have entertain the nation. Free it up to entertain, because that's what it does. And that's what creates likability. And we all know that that's the mantra around advertising, which is it does need to entertain. It needs to evoke an emotion. And so many brands suppress that because they're trying to also get a rational message in and whatever else, and be consistent in the personality delivery. So long and short of it is 90 days, getting to understand the business, went to go to share my brand strategy with the board, and Doug and Mary, the founders, were sitting at the front of the room. And before I start, I said, oh, Doug, Mary, I'm very, very nervous. And they were like, why? Why are you nervous, Catherine? I said, because I've never presented a brand plan to the founders of the business. But actually, ironically, they made my job very, very easy, because the truths of the brand, and there are so many, and we could talk for many hours about this, were there from day one. And they just got a little bit lost. So, you know, the undeniable truth that Doug and Mary are maniacal about making a positive difference to people's lives. It's the most democratic brand. They don't want to miss anybody. They love the fact that we have celebrities to children coming into our stores. They truly believe that it's not about selling glasses. It's about changing the quality of people's lives. So again, a gift of the pandemic was it allowed us to start telling a very different story. Yes, we had the Barnard Castle, which was fabulous. And actually we entered the British public for a marketing award. it's the most genius entry. It got picked up in the media.
Yes.
They didn't win, which I think was mean. But we loved that, you know, and it was so brilliant as a marketer to see the British nation basically do that job for you. And so we continued to entertain the nation because we all needed to be entertained in the last year. We put a post out after a weekend of Premier League football where there were like an incredible amount of goals scored. We just put a post out and said to all Premier League defenders, we're open for a free test for you on Monday. 8 million organic reach. Because it was the personality that continued. But we also started to tell the stories of what our store colleagues had been doing through the pandemic, because they did remain open for urgent and essential care. Life-saving stories, sight-saving stories, with a real authenticity and warmth about actually what is the difference we make in people's lives. And a couple of things have been really great about that. We polled people who had been brand rejectors. And when they started to see this storytelling, 50% of them said they were likely or very likely to try Specsavers next time around. I mean, you know.
That's unheard of from a brand marketing point of view.
Exactly. And all we were doing were telling human stories. And, you know, the best leaving gift I've received and I will receive is that the camp, and we called it Open for Care, was the kind of platform of the idea, was recognized as the best proactive comms during COVID in an awards last week. So in the healthcare sector, and the team so righteously deserve it, because it was a different, the personalities there, the Should Have still there, but actually I think really what I hope my legacy for the brand is to remind everyone of the human impact of what we do and not get caught up on the sales figures, because the sales figures will follow. Mm-hmm. And the final thing I'll say just in terms of that, when my departure was announced, one of our partners in the store in Luton, she wrote to me, and again, it's probably the most precious piece of feedback that I think probably had in my career. She just said, I'm really sorry to see you go. Thank you for reminding me why I do what I do. Because when you reframe it to, we get out of bed every day to make a positive difference to people's lives, because when they can see and hear their world better, life is better. it's what everyone knew, but it was just suddenly the, and excuse the pun, the lens turned and everyone was looking through it in a different way. And my God, it's way more motivating to see those stories that, I mean, there are amazing stories of life and sight saving and, you know, making a difference. It's way more motivating for anybody to see that than count the number of frames you've sold.
Yeah, to talk about, you know, a purpose-driven brand and putting purpose front and centre of everything you've done. And it's a very easy switch, but it's one that is often missed.
Yeah, and, you know, and I credit Doug and Mary, because as I said, my job wasn't difficult. I literally just had to remind everyone of, and this wasn't a fabrication, this wasn't, oh, it's all about purpose now, let's find a purpose. Mm. Doug and Mary were adamant about it when they started. They used to go out and visit people in their homes to look after their sites, you know, 35 years ago, because they didn't want anyone to miss out. And we have a home service now because we don't want anyone, if they can't come into store, we don't want people to miss out. So, you know, it is an astonishing brand with a lot of purpose at its heart. Who do some remarkable things, which we just need to start telling people about.
Just before we wrap up, what's next?
Well, that is the million-dollar question. So Michael, my partner, which I spoke about earlier, he would love me to be back at work on April, let's say the 5th. He'll give me Easter off, but that's not happening. So two things are happening next. One, to re-nest, is what I'm calling it. So, you know, we've been out of the country for 3 years. We need to kind of put our feathers down again and, you know, and create the nest again. So give time and the right energy and not kind of outsource that. So I'm really looking forward to that. And then, you know, I'm very lucky. I'm having, you know, some really great conversations about different opportunities. But I'm not rallying against anything that I didn't enjoy in my previous job. So, you know, sometimes you go, right, it's ready for a change because I want this, I want more money, I want different culture, I want different sector. So in some ways I don't have that kind of thing that's making me go, I don't want this, apart from maybe not an island in the middle of the channel to go and live on, which, by the way, Guernsey is a beautiful, beautiful place. It's just, it's, you know, it's just not where our hearts were. So talking, you know, doing a lot of talking at the moment and being inspired by things that I didn't think I would be. You know, I've been really, really fortunate through most of my career to work for some very well-known brands, big brands, well-established, global. I'd be surprised if I find myself at another one. That's all I'm going to say. And it's not because I know what I'm going to do,
yeah,
but I know where I'm getting my energy from. And it changes over time.
Well, Catherine, I mean, thank you for talking to us today. It's been really, really insightful. You've given us lots and lots to think about. Certainly given me an awful lot to think about. It's making so many connections with lots of models that we use and how you could use this in coaching. So it's been truly wonderful. And unfortunately, we're coming towards the end of the podcast, but would you like to give us your three leadership essentials? I'm sure you could give us more, but your top three would be brilliant.
Well, before I do, I thank you so much for asking me. It's always a privilege to be asked, and I've really enjoyed reconnecting. I've enjoyed meeting you, and I hope your listeners have found, you know, some nuggets out of my journey, and everyone's journey is different. So the three top tips. Three is always difficult for me when it comes to leadership, but I'll start with the one which I think is the most potent. Any leader should ask themselves why someone should follow them. And for me, that is the most important thing, because it's so easy to be academic about it. You know, tick list of these things that create good leadership. But when you ask yourself why you will be lucky enough for someone to follow you, that is really, really critical. The second is, and it somewhat supports, I suppose, the first point, is how do you build a compelling narrative around possibility and vision? Because you have the responsibility, if you lead others, to inspire them to come on the journey with you. And I always cite an occasion in my career where I was given an amazing opportunity to recreate the marketing, the way marketing worked in an organization. And I was so chuffed by it because I'd been asking for it for a long time, and then I was given the opportunity to do it. And at this organization, I had always been really proud to have like some of the top employee satisfaction scores in the company globally, consistently. But the year I took on this challenge, my scores were the lowest in the whole company because I hadn't taken people with me. I assumed everyone knew what we were doing, why we were doing it, and was as excited as me. And I had this image in my head of I was kind of charging ahead, going, come on, guys, but didn't bother looking behind me. So I learned a really tough lesson. And again, I had to go back to my team over, like, you know, 150 people and say, guys, I got it wrong. I got it wrong. So learn the lesson from it. So that vision and inspiration is really, really critical. And if I have to choose a third one, and it's a little bit around inspiring people, but it's actually about empowering people to bring their best selves to work. And so that empowerment is a bit around the things we talked about before. You know, we're a tribe of adults who, if we're all on the same course and we all have the same belief and we all are inspired in the same way, let individuals be their best selves, either through giving them space or empowering them through coaching, and let them do it their way. And again, full circle back to maybe some of the challenges of people bringing diverse groups of people together, because when you do, it creates magic, it creates friction, and that's the energy. And you've got to, as a leader, know how to deal with that friction. So empower people to bring themselves and their best selves to work, but also help make sure that friction, because if everyone is different, make sure that friction becomes something sensational and not negative.
Can't thank you enough for giving up your time, and especially given we've gone over slightly. So thank you so much, Catherine. Please, as always, anybody listening, if you've got any feedback or comments, please do get in touch with us. We'll put details in the show notes.
And finally, I said, thank you again. And if there's any way that I can help anybody else, so someone's listening to this and they want to pick up the conversation, find me on LinkedIn, be more than happy to I've got time now, you see.
What an incredible gift.
No, not at all. I love making connections, so.
Thank you.
Thank you, Catherine.
Thank you so much for listening to the Building Better Leaders podcast. We hope you've got a lot out of this. If you'd like to read up a bit more on any of the content that you've heard in today's podcast, be sure to check out our website, scaffoldcoaching.com.